Peace is in the air. President Trump is preparing to meet with Vladimir Putin today. We'll cover the details of that meeting once we have it a little bit later. But he's already brought to an end a decades-long struggle in the Middle East. Closer to President Trump's home, he's also launched a new initiative to bring peace to the streets of Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, Europe is expanding its arms factories at a record pace, and North Korea is stepping up its military presence in Ukraine. We're going to look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Wherever in the world you live, your nearest big city probably has a massive crime problem. Here in the UK, it's gotten so bad that other countries are warning about the danger of phone theft in London and the lack of a proper functioning police force. You have a similar shameful situation in America's capital, Washington, D.C. But just this week, President Donald Trump took some dramatic action to try and deal with that. We'll hear more about this from our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yes, crime in big cities in the United States is a problem across the nation. When you look at the statistics of it, people will often comment on how much more common gun violence is in the United States than is in Europe. When you break that down, however, that's almost exclusively an urban problem. The big cities here in the United States are really devolving into third world conditions in many places. We saw that in particular in Los Angeles early this year with the Los Angeles riots. And now we're seeing it in the nation's capital. We got a particular spotlight where there was one of Elon Musk's assistants in the Department of Government Efficiency when he was in that office, Edward Korestein, was helping the government identify some wasteful spending. And he just noticed he's walking home from work or something like that. A woman in Washington, D.C. being robbed or assaulted by 10 black teenagers. And he actually stepped in to try to defend this woman and got beat up pretty bad.
I think some of the later reports say it was his girlfriend.
Actually, yeah, I didn't even really see what his relationship with the woman was. I've definitely seen the pictures where he's bloodied up pretty good. And it definitely got the nation's attention. Donald Trump sent troops earlier this week, National Guard troops, in an attempt to federalize the Washington, D.C. police force. Now, he can only do that for so many days. I think depending on what congressional department he talks to, he can only do that for 48 to 30 days. That provision in the law is designed to make it so that America doesn't have a permanent federal police force, but that they can federalize it in cases where the crime like this is getting out of control. He's also looking at changing some of the laws in Washington to allow the teenagers who perpetrated this crime to be tried as adults. And so the nation's watching this story unfold. I think the number of National Guard troops deployed to Washington, D.C. this week is about 800. And the Trump administration, they say this is just the beginning. They're actually looking into ways to crack down on crime more permanently. But what the Trump administration's looking at doing is establishing like a quick reaction force. According to the information the Washington Post had gleaned, this force would be basically like 600 like elite National Guard troops, 300 stationed in Arizona, 300 stationed in Alabama. So you'd have groups on either side of the country. That in the case like the LA riots, these troops could be deployed at a moment's notice to put down crises like that. But the fact that this is needed is also just showing just the problem with violent crime and insurrection that America is experiencing, which is something we've talked about a lot at the Philadelphia Trumpet over the years. It seemed like especially back during the Obama years, and then even with the George Floyd protest, we highlighted a lot about prophecies in Isaiah 1 verse 7 that specifically say your cities are burned with fire and that they're devoured by strangers. Some translations even translate strangers as aliens. So this is a prophecy directed to end time Israel, and as anyone who's read the United States and Britain in Prophecy, which I recommend you do, understands, America and Britain are part of end time Israel. So when it talks about your city is being burned with fire and foreigners devouring it in the midst of you, it's talking about cities in America and Britain being burned, and particularly being devoured by people who are not ethnically Israelite themselves. In the case of the Los Angeles riots, these are a lot of illegal immigrants from Latin American countries who are here. Donald Trump's idea for a quick reaction force is a pretty creative solution to some of this. But the Bible prophecy there in Amos 1, particularly that chapter starts out saying that, like, well, the ox knows who its master is, and the donkey knows where it lives. But Israel doesn't know me. And so getting to the root cause that, like, these end time nations of Israel, they don't know God anymore, and their way they're living is producing criminals at a rate that might require a quick reaction force to put down. But the just the quick reaction force to put down violence like this isn't going to be able to stop the cities burning with fire if the sins and the social problems keep producing the cause of the crime and the violence and the rioting.
But at least someone's taking crisis measures to kind of deal with this. I think looking at this coming from the UK, where you have a lot of the same problems and a government that puts its fingers in its ears and ignores it. And, you know, I've just been writing up a few lines this morning about Birmingham, just down the road from us here, where residents have been putting up Union Jacks, they've been putting up the national flag, and the local council has said, no, we're going to take them down. They're a threat to people. They're dangerous. They're a threat to the lives of pedestrians and motorists. They're dangerous obstructions. And the mayor of Birmingham is a foreigner. He was born, I think, Pakistan or Bangladesh. He's not even British. You know, we're having our major cities taken over by foreigners. Massive migration, massive crime. A third of Birmingham is Muslim, and nobody does anything. At least you have President Trump taking action. But do you think, is there any truth to this accusation of he is becoming too king-like? He is taking to himself more power than the Constitution gives him? Or, you know, is this just something that has to happen and that he does have the power to do?
I will say that is definitely something I, in particular, just have concerns about generally in law enforcement. I wrote an article more than 10 years ago now titled, like, Why Does the EPA Need Its Own SWAT Team? Where I actually go through in pretty detail why the founding fathers of America said that a standing army won't long be a safe companion for liberty. They moved to keep most law enforcement local, local city police, county sheriffs, state police. They did do a marshal's service, but it wasn't really till the post or like Theodore Roosevelt's time that you got an FBI. A Federal Bureau of Investigation. So for most of American history, they've been pretty strong attempts to stop there from being any sort of federal police force so that the government couldn't not use it tyrannically. Now, at the same time, the founders also believed that, like, the Constitution they wrote is only suitable for a moral people, so for their system of like decentralized policing to work. It stopped a king or a dictator or a tyrant from taking over, but they realized that because they gave the people that freedom, that they were going to have to police themselves and raise children that don't become juvenile delinquents and uphold the law in their own homes so that there isn't this mass crime problem. Benjamin Franklin having said at one point that like the more corrupt or the more sinful a nation becomes, the more they have need of masters. So they even thought, and in some societies, I think they Franklin in particular, commenting on the French Revolution, said that he just didn't think that country was ready for an American style republic, that there were just too many social problems that had the need of a strong man. So far in Donald Trump's case, he hasn't federalized the Washington, D.C. police for longer than he's allowed to. Some people are saying that he didn't need to do it, that the crime wave wasn't that bad. And I think I've driven through Washington, D.C. before, and there's there's definitely some bad parts of that city. So I may agree with more Trump there that this was needed, and he hasn't broken the law yet in this case. And his idea for a quick reaction force, like I said, is a creative one that would allow basically a small standing group to be deployed to cities around the nation that are suffering from this type of violence, but without actually establishing a permanent presence. So I think everything he's done so far has been really good solutions to a crime problem. And he hasn't really broken any laws that would warrant calling him a king or a tyrant or anything like that. Abraham Lincoln saved the Union in the Civil War, and he took on some king-like power or some even dictatorial-type powers to do that just because the crisis was so bad. But no, I do think that is a good point that bears watching, though, that the main problem here is the crime, but as the crime gets worse and the nation has to take more authoritarian measures against it, there could be a long-term risk to the system of freedom America has enjoyed for a couple centuries, just because the people aren't showing the character required to live in a society where there's that level of freedom.
That's a good point that the Constitution is there. It only functions when you have a moral people. And without that, I mean, how do you bring about law and order and preserve the Constitution? And it shows that this crime, this immorality, this migration, I mean, it is fundamentally a threat to America's survival as a constitutional republic. What other stories did you have from the US this week?
Yeah, there's another one, actually a big story that I almost put in the top spot and then decide we've talked about it, related issues quite a bit over the last couple of weeks. So I'd highlight a different story in America. But the on the unfolding like Russiagate, Obama scandals, they had some more declassified documents here, particularly exposing Representative Adam Schiff. When Tulsi Gabbard did her first batch of the like the Obama files, she talked about how Obama knew the Russia collusion accusations against Donald Trump were false and based on the Steele dossier, and that he ordered a new intelligence assessment where his top spy chiefs really faked some information to make it look like Donald Trump was guilty of a crime he was not guilty of. And then they leaked that new intelligence assessment to the media. And now we're seeing that like Adam Schiff was one of the primary people giving permission to leak classified documents to the media. There's even a in some of these documents talking about how one of his underlings even expressed concern that this was like treasonous activity. It's like he wasn't in a position with the authority to declassify documents. And so the fact that he was telling people to give this to the media was illegal. And he may be held for account for it. If Pam Bondi wants to start getting some convictions, I think Adam Schiff may be the easiest, the lowest hanging fruit at this point. Some of the people like Barack Obama with presidential immunity, it's going to take more of a case to bring them to justice. But I think Adam Schiff here, it's like you've pretty much got like email and other records saying that he's giving permission to leak classified documents about the Russia collusion scandal, which was false anyway, just to undermine Trump when he was in office. So that is another big story we're keeping an eye on. Other small one, another one, yeah, Tulsi Gabbard's on a roll. She also confirmed that there's an investigation into Dr. Anthony Fauci for perjury regarding his role in gain of function research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. It's now pretty well known that the COVID pandemic that caused so much damage around the world was a virus that leaked out of the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Particularly, it's a virus made by the Chinese splicing together a bat coronavirus and a mouse coronavirus using technology that was developed at the University of North Carolina, which was in collaboration with Wuhan, teaching them how to do some of these things. And I'd have to go back through and double check. It's been a few months since I've written on this, on exactly how Anthony Fauci phrased it. But I know some of the things that he said about America's involvement in Wuhan and about America's gain of function research were just outright lies designed to make it look like the United States had nothing to do with this. When we were giving some pretty cutting-edge bioweapon technology to the Chinese in a very irresponsible way. And so and then one other piece of some big news that could happen is Justice Clarence Thomas is he made some statement about how this court should reconsider a lot of the courses the cases it's made using an incorrect interpretation of substantive due process. It's kind of a mouthful. But basically, what it means is that the Supreme Court might, because there's a decent chance they may look at the Hodges versus Obergefell ruling that legalized homosexual marriage. That ruling basically interpreted the privacy right in the 14th Amendment is saying that like states could not make laws against homosexual marriage. However, when the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, they kind of took a very different interpretation of that privacy clause. And so now that we've ruled that it's not constitutional for the federal government to force states to allow you to get abortions, equally so, it's not constitutional for the federal government to force states to issue homosexual marriage licenses.
Great. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. President Trump had a big success last weekend, bringing an end to a conflict that goes back decades. To tell us more about it, we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Last Friday, President Trump declared peace between two former Soviet rivals, not Russia and Ukraine this time, but Armenia and Azerbaijan, two countries in the South Caucasus, that little bridge that connects European Russia with the Middle East. The borders between where the Middle East is a bit fuzzy, so I'm claiming it for my region this time. These are two countries that have been going to war almost even before the Soviet Union broke up. Their Armenians are Orthodox Christians, Azeris are Muslim. The populations and the political borders don't necessarily match up. There's plenty of Armenians living in Azerbaijan and a part of it, Azeri territory that's cut off from the rest of it with Armenia in the middle. You could see on the map here. They've fought several skirmishes on and off for decades. There have been plenty of ceasefire attempts, plenty of international brokering, and so far, including from Russia itself, So far, nothing has been able to bring these two together, but according to President Trump, they finally had a breakthrough and are going to move forward in peace.
Now, the recent history of this, there was that big conflict over Nagorno-Karabakh in 2020. So this was a disputed area between the two of them that Armenia basically controlled. And Azerbaijan, they'd been arguing, they'd been fighting over this for decades. And then 2020 was this major moment where Azerbaijan used the latest drone technology to take over this territory in a matter of days, weeks. And it will go down in history as one of the, perhaps the first major drone war. And I think what we've seen now in Ukraine, what Israel have done, have all built on this. And that was a real watershed moment from that use of technology. But now that the two have not come up with a lasting peace after that. And the key contention is this chunk of Azerbaijan that is cut off by Armenia. And Azerbaijan wants a route to it. And that is a major threat to Armenia. Like this has been an important sticking point because it really does. It's a very small slither of land, something that would connect Azerbaijan to Armenia, to their other part of the territory. It transforms the Caucasus and even the Middle East. Because if Azerbaijan has this, they have a land route from their main kind of heartland to Turkey, their top ally. Makes it massively easier for Turkey to get into the Caucasus, to resupply their allies. It also, though, cuts Iran off from Armenia. It's right on the Iranian border. Iran has a very significant Azeri population. This is something that that they're very concerned about. For Armenia, you know, they've been very reluctant to grant some kind of transport corridor because this is potentially existential for them. Like, they were defeated really badly in that war. If Azerbaijan can get even greater support from Turkey, Turkeys and Armenians have very bad blood going back to the Armenian genocide 100 years ago. I mean, with that kind of Turkish backing, potentially Azerbaijan could destroy Armenia, wipe out their enemy. And so everything is repeatedly broken down on this corridor. And that was the heart of President Trump's peace deal last weekend.
Yes. It's technically known as the Zangezur Corridor, but as of Friday, we have a new name for it, the Trump Route for International Peace and Prosperity. This is going to be managed by the United States, and this is why the United States is getting involved. It's going to be developed by American contractors. We don't know who, per se. We don't know what infrastructure for, say, resource extraction or whatnot they're interested in, but President Trump has said he's interested in some fossil fuels, and potentially even American soldiers, private contractors, or even maybe some other government involvement to monitor everything. Armenia gets a bit of a token benefit of it, according to the agreement being under Armenian law. But as you said, this is a very big risk for Armenia. And it's also important to know this isn't actually a peace treaty. They haven't actually opened up their borders yet. They haven't exchanged prisoners of war. The text doesn't even mention that. It's more of a framework for going forward.
An important clarification, but I mean, this kind of strikes me as a bit of a genius move from President Trump. I mean, we have had a lot of negative things to say about Donald Trump's approach to making peace. And there is a willingness to trust evil nations. There's a desire to try and get peace through compromise. Like, there's a fundamentally flawed direction in his peace negotiations. This kind of seems brilliant to me, though, purely here, where he brings peace between two nations and at the same time establishes a U.S. presence in the Caucasus, which is something that America hasn't really had since Russia invaded Georgia in 2008. And you had, you know, Georgia was a very robust American ally, sent troops to Afghanistan, sent troops to Iraq. You had a U.S. military presence in Georgia. A lot of that changed with Russia's invasion there. Now America is back, and they're back on the border of Iran. This, like you said, America, they've got development rights in this corridor on a 99-year lease. So America will be able to build railways, oil, gas, fiber optic lines, all of this. And you're next to Iran. You're in Russia's back door now. This is an area that Russia, even during a lot of the Cold War, did not have to worry about the United States. Now they do. There's still a pretty big mountain range to get up through. You've got the Upper Caucasus, but still, that's a pressure point they can apply on Russia they couldn't before. And China. Like China's Belt and Road Initiative, China connection with Europe, runs through this region. And now the United States has a potential to maybe own a stake in a key piece of that jigsaw puzzle. So this is a very strategic move. I mean, I think more solid strategic thinking than we've seen from the United States maybe since Ronald Reagan. I think there's a lot of forethought that has gone into this, and it's about, I mean, it improves America's position with confronting Iran, Russia, and China in one move, and at the same time tries to bury the hatchet between a couple of nations. Geopolitical Futures had an article on this where they wrote, the South Caucasus region connects the West with the heart of Eurasia, so Washington's involvement in ending the standoff was both urgent and crucial. Having improved ties with Azerbaijan places Washington in a strategically advantageous position with regards to Russia and Iran, and could counter, if not curb, China's influence in Central Asia. They conclude, the signing of the TRIPP trip deal is nothing less than the decongestion of a crucial choke point. And then they say, either way, U.S. involvement in the South Caucasus is a significant opportunity. Now there's, and the opportunity is the right word, it's not a, they've got an opportunity to do a lot. There's a lot that isn't necessarily done. But big change in America's strategic position in this region. But it's not just America's position that this changes.
To go in, what you're saying, this Zangezur Corridor, this literally borders Iran. America could theoretically have a military base literally on Iran's border. And Russia's part, they've been trying to do something in here for 30 years. But it's not only the United States, Armenia, Azerbaijan, those are the three countries that get the cameras, those are the three that are holding up the piece of paper, but there's an important player involved in all of this that you mentioned earlier, but is a lot more pulling the strings, you could say, than what most people realize, and that is Turkey. Turkey, as you mentioned, is Azerbaijan's big ally. It's one of Armenia's mortal enemies. Armenia has a border closed with Turkey. At the announcement of this, Turkey said they're willing to open up their border with Armenia too. It's almost an even bigger milestone, you could say, than the one between Azerbaijan. But what does Turkey have to get with all this? Well, Azerbaijan is a Turkic-speaking people. They're closely connected with Turkey. If you go even past into the rest of the former Soviet sphere, all the Stan countries, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, etc., those are all Turkic-speaking countries too, and Turkey has immense links with them as well. But it doesn't have geographical links. To this point, if you wanted to do business between Central Asia and Europe, you had to basically either go through Iran or go through Russia and some of its allies, like Georgia, which is now closer to Russia. At this point, Turkey can basically bypass all of that and reestablish these links that it has with its historic, at least linguistically, close people, and turns it almost into a bit of a hegemon. This is what the Sufan Center said about the deal, quote, while Turkey was not present during Friday's White House summit, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan played an important role in negotiations up until that point. Not only is the trip a strategic success for Turkish regional interests, but it also cements its growing role as a regional hegemon, replacing Russia, which has long held that title, end quote. So, obviously, only President Trump knows what President Trump is thinking, but America's obviously very far away from the Caucasus. If you want a presence there, you have to have a partner there. And there's basically three world powers that have a stake in there. There's Russia, there's Iran, and then there's Turkey. And it looks like at this point, President Trump is trying to use Turkey as like a counterweight to diminish those other two powers' presence in the region and use Turkey almost as a, like, America's door into the region. And by that extension, it means building up Turkey, giving Turkey these benefits that allow it to expand. And they are quite big benefits. Azerbaijan's a huge exporter of natural gas as well as oil. The Stan regions, as I mentioned, on the other side of the Caspian Sea, they're huge sources of natural gas, of uranium even, if you get into Kazakhstan. If these can all of a sudden become part of Turkey's sphere of influence, you're basically looking at the biggest sphere of influence Turkey has had since the fall of the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, the energy is a great point. I mean, you bring up excellent points about how this benefits Turkey as well. But if you want alternatives to Russian oil and gas and your Europe, Turkey is one of the most promising options. And they do already have pipelines that go from Azerbaijan. And exactly like you said, like if you want to bypass Russia, getting oil and gas from Azerbaijan is big, but then also getting it from the other side of the Caspian Sea via Azerbaijan opens up even more. That pipeline currently goes through Georgia. So it's still the other side of Georgia to the Russian border, but you've got, Russia has some levers there. Being able to shift, potentially build new pipelines that don't do that, that could be huge for Turkey. At the same time, Turkey has just started selling Iraqi oil and gas again from the Kurds in northern Iraq. They've said they're building new pipelines in Syria. Like, there's a concerted policy from Turkey to expand their political power using their pipeline network. And then this turbocharges that. And all of this makes Turkey a very strong potential partner for Europe as they're looking for sources for energy. And then even influence throughout the Middle East. And people have been talking for years now about neo-Ottomanism, this kind of Turkish policy of building a new Ottoman Empire. You've got Turkey now setting up military bases within Syria. And we had our interview with the representative from the Syrian Network on Human Rights. And she made the point, okay, it's too simplistic to say, well, Syria is just a Turkish puppet state. But at the same time, Turkey does have tremendous and growing influence in Syria. You're starting to get Turkish military bases being built now in the Red Sea. They're building up their navy. They have major economic challenges, but they're creating a massive overseas reach. And this really does, like you say, cement their connection to Central Asia.
Even they have linguistic connections there. They've never actually been a part of Turkey. Those connections ended when the Turks migrated from there in the Middle Ages and settled in the Middle East. This is basically new territory. Forget neo-Ottomanism. This is Turkey expanding into the old Soviet Union. And for our power that's ascendant as Turkey, you could see not just what they're planning on doing, but just the ambition behind that. If they're even planning on challenging Russia directly in a place that they've never been challenging before, that shows that President Erdogan has very big global designs for what he wants 21st century Turkey to look like.
And this is a critical crossroads. We read that from Stratfor, from Geopolitical Futures. But one of the key prophecies that we talk about when we come to the Middle East is this clash between the King of the North and the King of the South, this clash between a radical Islamic power led by Iran and a European Christian revived Holy Roman Empire, and these two are going to clash. And you go back to when the Roman Empire and the Persian Empire were clashing, this is where those clashes happened. This was the border between the two, and it sounds a little counterintuitive because you look at a map and it's not the closest bit between Europe and Iran. You'd kind of think more Syria, upper Iraq. But when you're marching large armies, you need water, you need food supplies. A lot of those areas on the most direct route are desert. So those armies would march through Armenia. And there was always back and forths over who got to appoint the king of Armenia. Was it Persia? Was it the Roman Empire? They fought massive wars. Armenia was kind of this proxy that just bounced between the two for centuries. So this is... If we're looking for this key prophecy, what happens in this battleground is very important for that prophecy. And then that brings us to another part of that, which is Turkey's role in that prophecy, because Turkey is singled out as playing an important role in this King of the North alliance. And them moving into this area and controlling this area just makes them all the more valuable as an ally for Europe and the Holy Roman Empire.
Mr. Gerald Fleury, our editor-in-chief, made this point in a 2013 Key of David episode called Turkey is Going to Betray America.
Why would God declare that he's going to totally destroy one nation on this earth physically? Why would he do that? Why would God have reason to do such a thing? What could cause him to make such a prophecy, and it is one of the most ominous prophecies in all of the Bible that you need to understand, because it is going to impact you and your personal life. It's going to impact you, and you'll see that. But this nation sits astride one of the great sea gates of the world, and it's a part of Europe and a part of Asia. And it's something that geopolitically we really need to understand. And you don't see too much of that understanding today. But the nation of Turkey is in NATO. That's a North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And they have made a treaty with America and Europe. We've made that treaty together for protection, to protect the countries from the enemy, other enemy nations. And I mentioned last week that Turkey has been given some of our nuclear bombs, and they were designed to fit their airplanes. And all of that was done because, well, we're all members of NATO. But it is unusual when a country will take their bombs, their nuclear bombs, and put them in another country. That is also very risky and dangerous in oh so many ways. Now, we are supposed to have technical control of those nuclear bombs, but do we have real control? Or technically, let's say we're supposed to control them, but are we really? Are we really? I'm going to show you in a Bible prophecy that Turkey is going to betray America. Believe it or not, that is what is prophesied in your Bible. President Erdogan of Turkey has already allied himself with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which is a terrorist organization that spawned Hamas and Al-Qaeda and has all kinds of jihadist networks around the world, including in America. So is this a good ally for America? He has publicly stated how he hates the Jews.
So as Mr. Fleury said, as you said, Turkey has a very unique role to play in Bible prophecy, and that has to do with its prophetic identity. And Herbert W. Armstrong, the editor-in-chief of our predecessor magazine, The Plain Truth, has pointed out decades ago that the Turks actually descend from the patriarch Esau and the people of Edom, a biblical people that, like the people of Israel, descend from Abraham, descend from Isaac, and they were supposed to, at least by birthright, get the promises that God made to Abraham of a special nation. And you could read in Genesis chapters 27 of how the patriarch Jacob, later named Israel, took that birthright from Esau, took the blessing his father Isaac was supposed to give to Esau, and got it on himself. And there was big hostility between the two brothers. This is what Mr. Armstrong writes in The United States in Britain and Prophecy. The children of Israel, through sin, were driven out of the promised land that belonged with the birthright. The Turks came to power and dominion, and for many centuries possessed that land. Those descendants, the Turkish people, occupied Palestine 400 years before Britain took it in 1917. Esau's descendants always have lusted for that land, central promise of the birthright. The Turks have truly lived by the sword, end quote. So a bit of history there that the United States and Britain prophecy could elaborate more on. But the point is, that old enmity is still there. The Turks, not just the promised land itself, but just the whole birthright itself, that was given to Ephraim and Manasseh, two tribes of Israel, the United States and Britain, which again, Mr. Armstrong's book goes into more detail. But that thinking is still there on going after the countries that have the birthright. And there's a particular prophecy in the book of Obadiah, smallest book in the Old Testament, that is directed against Edom or Esau and speaks of them aligning with the Holy Roman Empire against the nations of Jacob. Obadiah 10 says that Esau will commit, quote, violence against your brother Jacob. This is verse 11 and 14, again, of Obadiah, only one chapter. In that day that you, Edom, stood on the other side, in the day that strangers carried away captive his forces and foreigners entered into his gates, that is, the people of Israel, and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even you were as one of them. Verse 14, neither should he have stood in the crossway to cut off those of his from Jacob, from Israel, that did escape, neither should you have delivered up those of his that did remain in the day of his distress. And as prophecies for this, and Mr. Armstrong, Mr. Floria said that Turkey is going to betray not just the state of Israel in the Middle East, we've seen a lot of that for the past few years, but America and Britain. How does Turkey betray America and Britain when they're on the other side of the world? Like, it doesn't, there's a lot that is unclear at that point. You're literally getting America and Turkey working on this very, very crucial peace deal right now that is making America and Turkey partners, that is America empowering Turkey, and that is putting an American presence, very important economic and even military presence potentially, on Turkey's doorstep and reliant on Turkey.
And even as you brought out in that quote from Obadiah 14, it talks about the crossway. And it draws attention to Turkey's role as this crossroad power, as playing a major part in that betrayal. And Turkey very literally is at the crossroads of Europe and Asia. They've got that bridge going over the Bosporus that is the dividing point between Europe and Asia. The Caucasus is a kind of crossway. This brings them, this kind of expands them as a crossway power. And again, the Bible specifically talks about their betrayal in connection with this role at the crossroads of the world.
Indeed. And so when you see America and Britain and Israel start to get entwined with Turkey more, start to, I guess you could even say, look to Turkey for protection as almost a guarantor of this deal, then you can see that this betrayal is going to be moving forward. How this particular deal plays out with this, Bible prophecy is silent, but this betrayal that Turkey does is going to be extremely heinous and extremely directed, as Mr. Fleury mentioned, not to some faraway countries, but to you, to the average person, like, in Western nations.
Well, thank you for that, Mihailo. Any other stories from the Middle East, then, that are worth paying attention to?
One other story I'd like to bring up. Middle East Eye released an article this week saying that Egypt has been training Palestinian security officials to replace Hamas once the war in Gaza is over. This is going back to an agreement they've had in the 1990s to help train up Palestinian Authority security personnel. It's unlikely Israel is going to let the Palestinian Authority come into Gaza, but it shows Egypt is preparing for the day after Hamas, and they're helping Israel at least have an alternative to that. For a lot of people in the Arab world, especially plenty of Egyptians themselves, this would look like collaborating with the enemy. And we're expecting big changes in Egypt. We're expecting massive political realignments towards radical Islam and Iran. A popular revolution against a so-called collaborationist regime could very well play into that. We've seen that happened a bit over 10 years ago now, and we may see something similar soon.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mihailo. This week, Germany's new government under Friedrich Merz passed its milestone of having been in office for 100 days. It's prompted a lot of articles looking back at how well it's doing. And not good is one frequent answer. A new poll showed that Germany has a new most popular party, the far-right Alternative for Deutschland. They're now in first place, according to an RTL-NTV poll. They have the support of 26% of the population, compared to 24% for the Christian Democratic Union and Christian Social Union bloc that currently leads the coalition. So Friedrich Merz has failed to draw support away from the Alternative for Deutschland the way that he wanted to. Meanwhile, another poll showed that 67% are dissatisfied with this government, two-thirds of the country, which says a lot about Germany's political dilemmas right now. You have two-thirds disagree, but those two-thirds that do disagree, disagree in very different directions. Basically, one-third want him to move in a much more right-wing situation. Another third want him to move in a much more left-wing direction. This widespread division makes it very hard for any government to get anything done. And this is a very important trend to watch, as Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry outlined in A Key of David back when Germany's government first fell. And he went through in that Key of David prophecies in Daniel chapter 11 about the imminent rise of a strongman and how that strongman will come to power. Here is what he said about some of those prophecies.
Dangers. Notice something it says in Daniel 11. You can read verses 21 through 31. It tells a story about this power. But I want to read to you verse 21. It states that the people shall not give this Antiochus the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Well, what do you know? This man, the strong leader, is about to take over and really hijack the Holy Roman Empire, or that the European Union that will become the Holy Roman Empire, with 10 kings and not 28 countries like they have now. They're going to have 10 kings, and this strong man will rule over them. Where is this all leading? How could they allow a man to hijack this powerful Germany that rules over all of Europe even now in many ways? Here's what I wrote in 2002. This man doesn't come to power the honorable way, by being voted into office. I wrote in November 2002, quote, he takes it dishonorably. He will work behind the scenes and come to power by flatteries, not votes. Not votes. Well, now this sounds dangerous. It's not done democratically. And that's going to cause real trouble in Europe and in this whole world. We'll see that shortly. Now, the Germans are just desperately trying to find a strong leader. They've had a weak leader for a long time, and all of the people are just clamoring for a strong leader. And that is going to cause them to allow their leaders to choose a strong man. You can read a lot about that in my booklet on A Strong German Leader is Imminent. But here we have something that is beginning to be a real problem that the world sees.
And as Mr. Flurry said there, the Germans, they really want a strong leader. They're clamoring for a strong leader, but their political system cannot give it to them. And so don't expect to wait 4 years of this coalition and then we'll have another election and then have a strong leader. Watch for this strong leader to come to power suddenly. So keep watching German government. Friedrich Merz is a stronger leader than Olaf Scholz. And I think we have seen more stability for these 100 days than we did see under Olaf Scholz. The fact that you have had some more stability, and I think he has not been quite as unpopular as Scholz was, does reflect some of that appetite for a stronger leader. He is getting criticized for the way that he kind of makes decisions, where he'll tend to make a very firm decision without consulting with anyone ahead of time, which is quite different from Scholz and Merkel, that were kind of just more of a weather vane and went whichever way that public opinion seemed to blow them. But keep watching for that rise of a strongman. And certainly you can see that Merz's government, we don't know exactly how that strongman's going to come to power, but you see the appetite there, and you see that that appetite is not fulfilled in Friedrich Merz. Even though he may well play a major part in kind of the strongman administration that's coming over Europe, we're still watching for that rise of that strongman. And we have our free book, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, that will tell you a whole lot more about that. Another interesting story from Europe this week, the Financial Times reported that 7 million square meters of new industrial plant devoted to weapons manufacture have been built in Europe. That's triple the rate that these factories have expanded thus far. That is, they judge this using satellite data looking down at Europe's industrial production, which is a bit mind-blowing that you can get that refined satellite data and look at factories growing and expanding like that. But Germany is arming for World War III was a feature article in our new Trumpet print. We can put a link to that in the show notes. This is yet another dimension of that important story. You know, we're watching for the rise of a strong man, but the arming is happening already. Europe is building up a strong military already. There's so much that is in place And then when you get that strongman, he can change Europe's personality, posture very, very quickly. And the factories that you need to build tanks, and even many of the tanks, they're there already. And so we've seen some pretty incredible turnaround in Europe's approach to the military already. And it'll be there for that strongman. Related to that, Germany is building what they're calling a Sparta drone mothership in Ukraine. They're working to mass produce that in Ukraine. The idea of a drone mothership is it's like one big drone that carries a lot of smaller drones. Quantum systems that make it says it can fly 6 to 8 hours and operate under a 200 kilometer radius. So you can kind of carry use this to carry short range drones a longer distance. I mean, Ukraine really has become this incredible testing zone. I've seen videos now where you're seeing a lot of drones controlled by fiber optic so that that signal can't be interrupted. There's a lot that's happening there. And again, this is various different European nations trying out, adjusting for new technology, the same way that European nations did and Russia did in the Spanish Civil War ahead of World War II. They're using Ukraine as a testing ground. And again, we have that article in the latest Trumpet print edition, Germany is arming for World War III. Now, of course, Russia isn't rapidly arming for a future war. They are trying to win a current one right now. One major effect of their invasion in Ukraine is to unite a lot of Asian powers together much more solidly. And we've seen some major changes in Russia's alliance with North Korea. This week, we're seeing more North Korean troops and weapons being brought into Ukraine. And our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques, has more to tell us on that.
Yes, that's right. The big story that I wanted to talk about this week is that North Korea will soon be sending 6,000 more troops to Russia to fight alongside Russians in the war. This was reported on Wednesday, and the North is also supposed to be sending significant quantities of main battle tanks, their M2020 main battle tanks, and also of their BTR-80 armored personnel carriers. Now, the plans say that these North Korean soldiers will be there mainly to help out in Russia's Kursk region. That's the region that Ukraine unexpectedly invaded last year and held territory in for many months. So it needs to be demined now and rebuilt in places. So the North Korean soldiers are going to be there ostensibly to help with that. But these soldiers could really end up helping the Russians in other places as well, including on the front lines in Ukraine, which we've seen with some previous deployments of North Korean soldiers to Russia. Those previous deployments, by the way, those are believed to have numbered around 14,000 North Korean soldiers. So with this additional six, that brings the total to about 20,000 North Korean soldiers. Not at all an insignificant number that the North has sent to help with Russia. In addition to that, North Korea has also sent Russia more than 12 million artillery shells, according to South Korean intelligence. That's the 152-millimeter shell. So North Korea has really been giving Russia very significant assistance throughout this war. And this takes on quite a lot of significance and importance when you view it in light of some specific Bible prophecies. First, there is Ezekiel 38, verse 2, which describes an individual called the Prince of Rosh. That's how it's translated in the New King James. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that the word Rosh there could be rendered Russia. So it really should say the Prince of Russia. And he has said that Vladimir Putin is this prince. And then if you read through Ezekiel 38 and 39, you see that this prince will soon be leading a massive army made up of men from numerous Asian nations into World War III. And then there's another passage in Revelation 9 that tells us exactly how massive that force will be. This is verse 16, and it says that it'll have 200 million soldiers. So just a stunning size. That's about 15 times larger than the largest army ever assembled in human history. But if you look at Russia today, they have a total population just over 140 million people. So Russia on its own could never field an army of 200 million soldiers. But Ezekiel 38 lists several ancient names that designate certain modern Asian nations who will subordinate themselves to Putin's Russia and make their armies a part of his 200 million man force. There are names there signifying modern China and India as well. And then when you come to verse 6, and with this week's news in mind, this is very significant. But in verse 6, it says that a people called Gomer will also lead their soldiers to take part in Putin's army there and be a part of this massive force. And Gomer, as we've talked about on the program before, this is the primary ancestor of modern Korea, as well as some other modern Asian nations. So these passages show that Korean soldiers will be a part of that huge multinational Asian force that Putin will soon be leading. And today we see North Korea already subordinating itself to Putin's Russia, supplying significant amounts of soldiers and weaponry. So this shows really that the groundwork is now being laid for North Korea to take its place in that Putin-led 200 million man army. And if anyone would like to understand the details of those prophecies, we have a booklet by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. It's called The Prophesied Prince of Russia. And it goes, really takes a deep dive into all of that. It shows how current events are beginning to fulfill these prophecies already and how they will continue to be fulfilled in the future. And it shows that ultimately there's a lot of hope in these developments that at this point look very sobering.
Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. Now, as I alluded to at the start of the show, I think the biggest headline this morning is this Trump-Putin summit about Ukraine taking place in Alaska, probably right now by the time that this goes up. And I think, you know, rightly, we're not going to devote a massive amount of time talking about what may or may not happen at this summit. We'll come back to it afterwards when we don't have to speculate. How long has this been planned? Is this about trying to change facts on the ground very rapidly, or is this something that's kind of been in the works, this troop surge for longer?
Yes. Well, we know that President Trump, even before January 20th, when he started his second term, he had been working to end the war between Russia and Ukraine. That was a pretty significant part of his campaign, was this promise to end the war. So really, he's been trying to persuade Russian President Vladimir Putin to enter into a ceasefire and eventually a full peace deal for months and months now. And I think that this meeting, which is taking place, as you said, later today, or by the time we air, it'll probably have already happened. It's in Anchorage, Alaska, and it is intended to advance that goal of President Trump's. And it's also, of course, a very interesting location for the meeting there, you know, Alaska being a part of the U.S. that America bought from Russia back in the 1800s. President Trump was apparently the one to insist on the meeting taking place on American soil, which he sees as sort of an act of submission on Putin's part. And President Trump appears to be hopeful that this meeting could bring about that ceasefire and eventually a peace deal that he's been hoping to broker for so long. And that is a noble goal, of course, to bring peace to this horrendous war that's been raging for more than 40 months now, and just to end all the killings. But there are a lot of concerns about how this might play out. First of all, just the general optics of this meeting, you know, a man of Putin's very wicked character being invited into America and treated as if his word actually means anything. That alone, I think, is shameful. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written several times about Mr. Trump's naivety regarding Putin and about his willingness to make deals with him and even befriend him to a degree. So that is sobering, I think, to see Mr. Trump's continued folly in this area. And I think we should probably expect this old KGB mastermind, Vladimir Putin, to continue trying to make President Trump sort of think that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is to blame for the war and other kind of fairy tales like that. And then we should also keep in mind that this meeting comes after several phone calls between Mr. Trump and Putin have taken place over the last 6 months. And after each of those calls, despite Putin's promises, he has only intensified his attacks on Ukrainian civilians, which was really an embarrassment for President Trump. This time, though, Mr. Trump does have more leverage against Russia, since he has shown that he is dead serious about putting sanctions on nations that buy Russian oil. He made that clear by putting a 50% tariff on India a few days back, India being the number one purchaser of Russian oil at this point. So that is a powerful tool that President Trump has. And that's, I believe, probably the reason why Putin even agreed to this meeting. But Putin is also not at all out of options. You know, we just spoke about the additional North Koreans who will be joining his ranks soon and the weapons coming into Russia from the North. There's also the ever-looming presence of China there, which could potentially increase its support of Russia. There's also India, of course, which has been drawing much nearer to Russia in recent months. And meanwhile, even though President Trump now has more leverage over Russia, he actually has less leverage over Ukraine. We've reached a point where European powers are now supplying more weaponry and aid to Ukraine than the U.S. is. And Ukraine's domestic weapons manufacturers are also, I think, exponentially more powerful now than they were a couple of years back. So that means that even though Mr. Trump is sort of trying to present himself at this meeting as being kind of in charge of what Ukraine does, with Europe increasingly in the picture and with other factors changing, that may not be the case as much as President Trump would like it to be. So, you know, the Ukrainians may not be willing to go along with the terms from a meeting that they've not even been allowed to attend, especially if the peace terms say that they'll have to give up some territory that Russia has not even captured yet, which very well may be part of Putin's and Trump's plan. So, you know, as you said, we wouldn't want to say too much about this, being that it hasn't yet happened. We'll have to see how it goes. And the true outcomes of it may not even be known for weeks. You know, sometimes with these sorts of meetings, it's difficult to know exactly how it'll play out. But I'm sure that there'll be a lot more to say about this on future Trumpet World episodes.
Great. All right. Well, thank you very much, Jeremiah. Thank you to all of our panelists. Thank you to George Haddad and Victor Granados for engineering and production. Thank you to you, the viewer, for joining us for our Trumpet World Week in Review. If you have any questions, any comments, please do get in touch. TrumpetWorld@thetrumpet.com. We would be very happy to hear from you. You can follow us on YouTube, on Rumble. All of our material is up on the website, thetrumpet.com as well. We had a show on Wednesday on the global rise in anti-Semitism, the parallels with the 1930s, the 1940s. Probably our most commented on ever show. And the comments kind of prove our point that you can talk about anything. We can talk about Sudan, Somalia, France, Germany, Canada, the United States, Australia. It's only when you talk about Israel and anti-Semitism and the Jews that you instantly get dozens and dozens of angry comments about just that one particular group. So, I mean, even the aftermath of that episode itself shows the dangerous rise of anti-Semitism. We've mentioned quite a few pieces of literature throughout the show there. We heard about the prophesied Prince of Rosh from Jeremiah at the end there. You can get all of our material at our website, thetrumpet.com. You know, what we're working to do in these Week in Review shows is just show you how the news each week brings your Bible alive, and that Bible prophecy is being fulfilled every single week, that world events are moving rapidly forwards towards the return of Jesus Christ, that we all need urgency, we all need to be busy. But in this show, we don't have the time to dig in deep, to often really provide a detailed proof of everything that we're saying. But we don't want you to take our word for it either. We'd really encourage you to go look at those show notes, look at things like The Prophesied Prince of Rosh. That's just a pretty short book. Read it for yourself. Prove it from the Bible so that you're not taking our word for it. And watch these urgent world events happen before your eyes. And that will bring just a whole lot of energy and excitement into your life. So we'd be very happy to send those to you. We will be back on Wednesday. We were able to line up what I think is a fascinating interview. Andrew talked to an ex-US Border Patrol agent. He's got a lot to say about the US-Mexico border, even the US-Canada border. So we'll have that on Wednesday. Tune in then. And until then, keep watching your world.